Welcome to The Winnow, a podcast about dining in the South and beyond. I'm Robert Moss, the author of Barbecue, the History of American Institution.
I'm Hannah Raskin, food editor at the Post and Courier.
Well, today we're doing the 5 and 10 edition of The Winnow because I think we have a couple of listicles here in the making. We'll do talk about 5 signs, 5 dishes, maybe a couple other 5 and 10 type items. And I think we got started on this whole idea from a reader's question to you, which is always like that because it gives us some good ideas.
Keep them coming.
I like this question. I think the question was, what are the 5 signs that a restaurant is legitimately Southern?
I wish I had the actual query here because it's not just a question. It was really quite the letter.
But okay.
So I can't remember all the capital letters that were involved, but it was something like the 5 top 5 tip-offs that, as you say, that the restaurant is legitimately Southern,
as opposed to illegitimately Southern. Or
right.
Not
We've
Southern
all been
at
to
all.
Those places. Yes, exactly. So, and his question was, and he said, well, he said, I'm not just talking about menu items, which I thought was a wise thing to say. So, as we know, those are easily faked. So, it's not just a matter of is shrimp and grits on the menu, but how can you tell that this place is, in fact, authentic? So, Robert, I came up with my 5, and I want to run through them with you.
Okay,
I had 5.
A couple of lists on my list, but you've thrown a bit of a wrench in it because of the, dishes.
Dishes is okay.
Yeah.
You can go dishes.
Because I have dishes, and then one of my lists I says, but what about decor? And I couldn't come up with anything, but maybe you have some
ideas. All right, well,
let's do your
5. Now, I should say at the outset, you know, as soon as this question came in, I went to kind of the Bible of our profession, which is John Edgerton's Southern Food, because I was curious.
Which sits on my shelf and is frequently pulled off the shelf.
And I had a feeling he may have addressed this very question, and indeed he did. So just to bring people up to speed, his book was released, I think, 86, 87.
Yeah, it was really there have been a couple of other books, but it was the real first book to sort of treat – just sort of try to do a sort of an end-to-end treatment of Southern food. What is it? And it's not just a cookbook, though there are recipes in it. It's not just a history. There's history in it. It sort of tries to tell about what people in the South eat and what it means about the South.
Exactly.
The cultural impact of it.
Exactly. To take food seriously. Yeah. And it wasn't just a peripheral to everything else.
And
really,
oh, shucks, here's Granny's fried chicken recipe. You know,
exactly. And John Edgerton obviously is an incredibly respected academic and all of this. But there is a through line from – I mean, he encouraged the creation of Southern Foodways Alliance. Mm-hmm. So many, many, many of the chefs that we now credit with reviving Southern food, that goes directly back to John Edgerton. Okay, so in his book, he outsourced the question as well. So since he didn't have a John Edgerton book to pick up, he asked his friends. And so he pulled them and said, what should I look for in a Southern restaurant? And some of the things they said, it should be one of a kind, not a chain.
Mm-hmm.
They said the ingredients should be fresh and not from a can. Now, this is of its time. They said they should not accept credit cards. This is long before Square was the way you checked out. They said that they should not advertise, but if they do, it should not be a billboard or a commercial on television.
Really?
Yep.
About the commercial on television I can see, but there seems to be a lot of billboards for what I would consider to be Southern restaurants.
I completely agree. So I'm not saying this is right or wrong, and neither
and
did John.
And this is the 80s, so things have changed.
Things have changed, right. So he just listed it. Oh, he said, I think that you were alluding to this earlier, there should not be hillbilly spellings on the menu.
So Poe folks, do you remember Poe folks?
I do, yes.
That's P-O folks, was not a legitimately Southern restaurant.
Not by this
It was
measure.
A chain. It had TV commercials. They did accept credit cards.
Right. Northern as you get, apparently.
And they had a hillbilly spelling.
They also said in a true Southern restaurant, I would love to know which restaurant even inspired this comment, but that, you know, the servers should not be in cover overalls and, you know, have a straw hat.
No straw hats.
I think that's fair.
Okay.
So that's where he kind of left it. And then, of course, again, if y'all haven't seen this book, it's worth picking up because he went out to many, many of these restaurants, many of which sadly are no longer around. So really did a nice job of chronicling some important Southern restaurants that in the 80s were still functioning. And some of them are still today. So I got to thinking about this.
And this is the times have changed. So there's a lot has changed since the 80s, I mean, there are Southern restaurants now all over the country. And
exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Are they legitimately Southern restaurants in Chicago? Or,
exactly. You know, exactly. Now, I always think of Chicago as a Southern city. I think we've talked about
Southern
that.
Influence, yeah.
So, I mean, there's been enough that the Great Migration led that way. So I very much believe there could be a Southern restaurant in Chicago. Now, as we all know from our travels, there are also now Southern restaurants in Phoenix and Portland and Milwaukee. So I had to come up with a test. What are the ways to know if they've really done it, or if they're just a northern restaurant serving a southern
menu. This will be your test if you're not in the South.
Either in the South or out of the South.
It applies either way.
Because who knows? People move everywhere these days.
Well, yeah, lots of people go, like San Francisco, somebody will come from the South and open a restaurant out there, and there we go.
Who knows? Right. So this is my test. Now, I was concerned. I came up with, so here's how I made it harder for myself. I felt like these five things had to be applicable no matter what price point this restaurant is at. So that's a little harder because, you know, it's very easy to say like, well, there'll be pickup trucks, and you know, which I think is pretty cynical. But anyhow, I wanted five things that could be applicable no matter what price point. Additionally, really, no matter what cuisine. I think we've come to the point in Southern food that we certainly accept a taqueria, a Vietnamese, you know, crab place. I mean, these can all be Southern restaurants. So I wanted to make sure that the five things I came up with were essentially cuisine neutral.
Okay.
So, but the problem now is now you could have a restaurant in New Hampshire and you're like, well, this looks like a Southern restaurant to me. So I had to impose some ingredient qualifications.
You have to.
I got two. So you got to pass this test in order to move on to the five signs. One, there's got to be peppers and vinegar in some form. Generally, on the table is a good place to put that. But, you know, whether you're in Appalachia, so there's just more vinegar in the food, or you're in Louisiana, so there are more peppers in the food. This is my way of knocking out most of the Midwest, essentially.
Order collards, you need some vinegar pepper sauce to put on it.
And additionally, there should be white sugar. So I think if all you have is that like weird sugar in the raw stuff tea, that's no good. So I don't think they necessarily have to bring – when you say tea, if they ask sweet or unsweet, I don't think that disqualifies as a Southern restaurant. But they should have the sugar on hand at the very least.
And it should be white sugar.
White sugar. It'd be nice if they made –
not just artificial sweetener.
If they made the sweet tea appropriately. But I'm not going to set the bar that high. All I'm going to say in terms of ingredients is if you ask for hot sauce or if you ask for sweet tea, those would be acceptable requests. That's all I'm going to say. And I think by that, I've eliminated at least 80% of the country. So I think I'm good there. Okay. Here are the five things I think signify a Southern restaurant. Okay. One, homemade bread, meaning...
And not necessarily brioche.
Exactly. Meaning, in fact, I am fine with a pan of Jiffy cornbread. Mm-hmm. But I believe that there is an emphasis on that starting starch. So, and two, going back to the taquerias, maybe it's the tortillas are of high quality. But I think there's some, so it could be a biscuit. It could be, as I said, cornbread. It doesn't even have to be made from scratch. But the fact that there is some sort of bread that's made in-house. Should I keep going or do you want to take these one by one?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Go ahead. Two, more vegetables than meat. And I think so just that generally the ratio, even if it's not actually a meat and three, but that there are plenty of vegetables and probably more vegetables than meat. And again, that's true across cuisine. Mm-hmm. And I would say, too, the vegetables are like, especially if they're serving the weird kind of unsexy vegetables, mm-hmm. like if they're serving rutabagas mm-hmm. or they're serving cabbage, if they're serving turnips, that's the kind of thing we see, I think, in a true Southern restaurant. You know, it might be a certain kind of greens, any of the greens. I mean, anything that's not kale, basically. Yep. Mustard greens, turnip greens.
Kale, when I was...
gets you no credit.
Grew up in Greenville, South Carolina, and I worked at a seafood restaurant up there, which is sort of like, at the time, was the fancy seafood restaurant in town. But, you know, a lot of just local folks would come in for, like, anniversaries and nice dinners. And we had kale, but not on the menu. We had a gigantic brown box of kale in the walk-in, which we would take and rip into tiny little pieces and then put a lemon wedge in it. So the kale was the garnish with a little lemon wedge back in the kind of restaurant where you got garnish on every plate.
That's so funny. You say that because actually I was just talking with Emery about
that was the first time I'd ever seen kale.
About Ruby Tuesday, where on the salad bar that made Ruby Tuesday famous, kale is a garnish. It's not actually.
Yeah, it was
just,
totally
it's
garnish.
It's just a garnish. But it's so interesting because Ruby Tuesday is a Southern-based restaurant. Is it right outside of Knoxville?
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, so well, they treat kale as a garnish.
Maybe that makes them Southern. I don't know. Kale was completely unknown, and I can't tell you the number of times I bring a plate to the table and somebody say, what's that green stuff?
Yeah, you
know?
Right.
And
right.
I'd say, kale. And they say, what's that? And I said, I don't know. It's that
but
green stuff.
But I do think, generally, this is one of the stories that still doesn't get out of the South beyond food circles, that like vegetables are so important here,
it really
obviously.
Is.
And you hear all that cliche, I hate that, about like, well, mac and cheese is a vegetable. It's like, no. There's actually a whole array of vegetables.
And the ones you mentioned, actually, I've been doing a lot of barbecue writing lately, working on top 50 list, big swing through North Carolina. The number of restaurants that have turnips and cabbage on the menu, and you know, not just coleslaw, we're talking about boiled cabbage.
That's right, boiled cabbage is I see it all the time. When I was doing my fried chicken story, often anytime you sit down, if it's still like a meat and two, meat and three, cabbage is huge. And it's interesting because that is not one that's been picked up by the fancy Southern restaurants.
No, it wouldn't. It's
never,
not.
Never. So I guess I could just say if you see a rutabaga, but I'm going to leave it at more vegetables than meat, and y'all know what I mean. Okay. Three. This one, there's got to be a little bit of leeway and interpretation, but there's a bulletin board by the front door. So which could be truly a bulletin board by the front door. So you see if someone has a truck for sale or who's, you know, who's got some sort of service they can sell you. Or in a higher end restaurant, I guess what I mean by this is if there isn't a bulletin board that tells you, you know, who can mow your lawn, probably the bartender can tell you. Yeah. Someone's got to know. I feel like if it's truly a Southern restaurant, it's kind of connected to the community around it. And it's a place where you can at least get some gossip.
Yeah, it's definitely locally connected. So that was number three?
That was number three.
Okay,
number four is, that your tea, sweet tea, whatever, comes in a styrofoam cup. So this is pretty standard, I feel like, at most affordable Southern places, that even though you're eating in, your drink is to go.
Yeah.
Almost always.
Yeah, and there's a lid and straw.
There's lid and straw.
Over there by the tea thing. So on the way out, you can top off and
exactly.
Take it with you.
And they don't.
And you'll have to go to the counter and ask for a to-go cup.
No, it's just understood. And I think that's the most Southern thing about it is that the hospitality extends beyond the time you may have for your meal. Taking it with you. So I don't know. In a fancier place, I don't know. Maybe it's the special mints they throw with your check that you're going to walk out with. But the idea that it's not just like an isolated part of your day. That dining is something that is actually the most important part of the day. Like you're gonna take a bit of it with you. So, and five, the references to the past, not in the way you do it, Robert, but saying like there's got to be one recipe that Grandma came up with. And again, this doesn't matter if you're making fried chicken or you're making tacos. It's like always. You know, I just recently wrote about a New Mexican restaurant in North Charleston, and I looked around and all the pictures are, they're actually selling hamburgers. And all the pictures are of the owner's father when he sold hamburgers at a market, essentially, in Mexico. And that struck me as just the most Southern thing.
Yeah, that definitely is.
That nod to the past. I feel like you need to some sort of family reference in even the smallest way. So picture, menu, recipe, or just saying thanks. Some sort of family association.
So those are really good lists.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to share with today. And I was really proud of my list.
I've got a list and myself.
There's
a fair amount of overlap.
Great.
Interestingly enough, with your list, because I didn't have quite as much context as the whole question, but my first three items were ingredients.
Okay.
And we'll talk about them. And some of these, I think, may not apply any more like they used to. But first one I had is, I think, in the same vein as you, I wrote cornbread rolls or mix, which is what they ask you at Lizard's Thicket up in Columbia as your choice for – and it just comes with everything. Every meal comes with a basket of either cornbread, which really means corn muffins, or dinner rolls or mix. And that cornbread, yes, it's probably the Jiffy brand, but it's bread. I wrote, as you were talking, quick breads, because that's really something about the South. Biscuits, cornbread, even dinner rolls to some extent, though dinner rolls are yeast breads. But, you know, that's a quick bread. You can make up a batter. You can make them quickly, and it's hot. You know, having a hot dinner, hot bread on the table goes way, way back in the South.
Absolutely.
So that was a good one. I had that as my first on the list.
Great.
I put grits on the list.
All right.
And like I said, this may not be true anymore. I actually put grits, especially breakfast. Because there was a time when you would not find grits on a menu outside the South. People didn't know what they were.
That's a good point.
Diners and everything. And people didn't make a big deal about it either. Grits was just something. It was grits or hash browns or, you know, it just came with your
and
breakfast.
Glenn Roberts came along.
Yeah, but then all those chefs, you know, we talked, I think, in past episode about Husk blowing up the Southern food all over the country. Now you can get these grits, but not, you would not find the kind of grits I'm talking about are not the stone ground orbs with cream and butter. They're white. Yeah. They're very pasty.
They're kind of watery.
They're watery. Yeah, you don't really eat them by themselves. You dredge your ham.
You need
whatever.
That hot sauce.
Yeah, you put a bunch of stuff in it.
Yep.
And then
I'll give you grits. And the other thing I would say, I feel like a tip off that a restaurant is faking the South, which may be just instinctual to you and I, but when they serve something at the wrong time, day part, like as they would call it in the restaurant industry. So grits, shrimp and grits is now accepted as a dinner dish, even though it may not have started that way. It's now kind of accepted. But like when there's a side, you can get like a side of boiled peanuts with your like fancy roast chicken. That is really wrong.
No, that's right. And grits, grits are just...
And even the grits, I always wonder when I see grits as a side item for dinner.
And a lot of times they're now grits cakes or they're going to be fried and fried
hominy. I think grits belong at breakfast.
Yeah, so that's why I said grits at breakfast.
And
grits, no one makes a big deal out of them. They're just filling and they're corn and they... You know, you have bacon alongside, and you just eat grits along with things. Mm-hmm. So that was a sign. Again, that used to be a marker. Like you knew you were in the South if you saw grits in the menu because no one anywhere else even knew what they were.
Right.
Now you'll see them at upscale places all over. Right. I had sweet tea as third on there. You know, though I have many conflicted feelings about sweet tea because tea in the South used to not be universally sweet. It's become sort of this marker. But it's still, you know, it. But I think it's sweet tea in the way that, like, I was in Louisville, Kentucky, which is firmly in the South, just eating in a Mexican restaurant. And I asked for sweet tea, and they brought me tea that wasn't sweet, but it was clearly sweetened with artificial sweetener. So, you know, even at the Mexican restaurants up there, everyone knows it's – and this is run by at least a Latino family. Not sure if they're from Mexico, but they've – you know – They're Southerners now, and they drink sweet tea.
They do. And so that's what I meant at the outset when I was saying if you should be able to ask for hot sauce or sweet tea anywhere. Yep. And that's – I was actually – again, Mexican restaurants in mind, they all bring sweet tea.
Now, the pepper and vinegar sauce, I got to give it that one. I didn't even think of that, but I think that's because just having been born and always lived in the South, even though I travel a lot, I just – until you said it, it's like, oh, you're right. Mm-hmm. You never see that anywhere but the South, do you? I guess you wouldn't have that in Nebraska somewhere.
Nope.
So, side note, I think this is – Nebraska made me think about this because I spent a lot of time in Lincoln, Nebraska doing work at one point. There's a – and I've noticed it other times traveling the Midwest. There's a big difference between the South. You mentioned the tea and taking it with you. The pace of dining in the South is much different. People aren't in a rush to get out. And when I was in Lincoln, Nebraska, working there, we'd ask the people I was working with, where's a good place to eat? And every recommendation included how quickly you could get in and out. And so it was like how much they would serve you and how – so like it's almost like this sport. Like, oh, you can be in and out in 17 minutes and get a big meal. It's so fast and cheap. And it's like, oh, that's great, but I really don't need to get in and out in 17 minutes.
Now I want to start looking around Southern restaurants to see if they have clocks. It's going to be like a Vegas casino. I wonder if they're like
– I just feel like you're not in a hurry when you come to a Southern restaurant because you're there to chat. You're there to talk.
Yeah.
So the speed is something I thought of just as you were talking. That was on my
clocks.
List. But clocks would be a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, because then I wrote on there, what about decor? Because I didn't want to do all food. And I think – I came up with one which is similar to yours, your bulletin board. But I think this is a Southern phenomenon. Mm-hmm. It's the placemat that has all the ads for local businesses.
I think it's all over
the
country.
Is that
country.
All over? Okay.
Yeah.
I just associate that with a certain type of,
of
community restaurant in the South.
It is a community restaurant. So it's not so removed from the bulletin board for sure. And a bulletin board, too, is not only in the South. But I feel like you got to have something
Your restaurant is not a poser pretending to be a Southern restaurant if it's got like a placemat with like a drywall company plumber and some florist, you know, his ads. And they're the local ads on there because there are ads for chains.
Right.
You have no billboards or TV.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, here's like you advertise this on the placemat.
Yeah,
so I think that's a sign of a not of a legitimate neighborhood restaurant or community restaurant. The other one I came up with is almost the same as yours. I said a shrine to a family member. Mm-hmm. Like if you really got to have, if you have that framed picture of granddaddy or grandma or even better, granddaddy and grandma looking at each other, you know, with flowers and stuff around them. That is such a Southern restaurant thing.
That is completely
one of my
Southern,
favorites. I can't remember the names of the people, but there's a pancake house up north of Myrtle Beach that has the owner's daughter went to Hollywood and it was an actress in a soap opera. And my wife recognized her. I didn't know who she was, but there's a shrine to their daughter with all her, you know, her headshots and her publicity pictures and all that kind of stuff. I said, that's a Southern restaurant.
That is great. Right. And you'll see the paintings sometimes.
And it's often, with usually like sort of a halo like glow around the hand. Poser restaurants don't have a portrait of grandma and granddaddy.
I feel like now we're giving too many tips. Now the poser
restaurant. Oh, now they will. Yeah. You'll walk into every little.
I
still like that's a good one about the hillbilly spellings.
Yeah, that's a good one. Right.
All right. So I think that's our five. I think you came up with some great ones. And
thank you.
I think that's something you can write on a little piece of paper and take with you. It's sort of like, along with your tip card to gauge restaurants. All right. Well, and that sort of leads to, I think, the 10, which is the next one I want to talk about. I just recently did a piece that's going to come out in a little while for Roads and Kingdoms on – and they do this thing. They do these city – which is a big online publication. They do these city issues. What do we call it? A web issue would be. Big web digital layout for city tours. So and they do them all over the world. And so they're working on one on Charleston. So I contributed for it. A History of Charleston in 10 Dishes, which is and they do these for cities all over the place, which is not so much to say that, tell me about 10 iconic dishes or tell me about 10, 10 must-eat dishes. It's more like, can you tell the story through just talking about 10 different dishes?
So in some cases, could these be dishes that were not repeated again? Like, would you pick and so this was served at Fort Sumter? I mean,
I think it was more like, there were no real rules other than given that general guidance. And I looked at what other people had done with other cities, but it was really more, telling the story of it. And so I thought that was a really interesting exercise to go through.
I feel like we should do this Family Feud style. Yeah. I don't want to guess.
So I don't know if we have to do all 10, but I'm be curious. May I put you on the spot and see if you had some that when you think of the dishes that not the dishes that necessarily everyone comes here and you have to eat, but what would you pick as ones that are just very representative of history?
Rum. Do I have to do these in order?
No. You can.
Okra soup. Mm-hmm. Let's see, Hoppin' John.
That was one of mine as well.
Uh-huh. And did this go up to modern times?
Yeah, it went all the way up to...
And so I would have chosen...
My last one was Triggerfish.
Triggerfish is a good one. Right before that, I don't know exactly how your timeline is spaced, but I would have picked that... what was it called? Like the Deep South Egg Roll or whatever? It was served at... It was...
We always did that.
What's that?
Who did that?
Who was the guy at Magnolia? It was Barrickman, I think.
Donald Barrickman?
Yeah, right.
I did shrimp and grits for that particular period.
That's fair.
Of the city's culinary emergence. Yep. And talked about, we were talking about grits earlier, shrimp and grits going from this just sort of local breakfast dish, plain white grits with little shrimp on them, to gussied up grits with tasso, which isn't even from Charleston, and these big trawler shrimp, and all kinds of gravy and herbs and everything else, just sort of representing how Charleston took local ingredients and gussied them up, and that sort of put them on the map culinarily.
Right. All right. What else is on your list?
Well, I started with, either pilau or purlieu or purlo.
Yeah.
Just as a way to establish varieties, establish, this is the foundation of Charleston's history and everything that came after, including the institution of slavery in Charleston, everything that underlies the rest of the history. I did go through okra soup and Hoppin' John next. Okra soup, I think, is great. Actually, I called it gumbo, and in parentheses okra soup, because that's what it was known as in the early, late 18th, early 19th century. Mm-hmm. Gumbo being the word for okra in several different African languages. So a lot of the enslaved Africans brought here brought gumbo with them, which was, at the time, was really just meant okra. And what was called gumbo back then wasn't what you think of in New Orleans with roux and andouille sauces and all that. It was basically an okra mm-hmm. and tomatoes preparation. Yep. You stew okra. And it's still around Charleston today, okra soup. And you know, people don't realize that's gumbo, but that's gumbo, yep. the old style gumbo. I like Hoppin' John because it merges rice with the red peas or cow peas, mm-hmm. which are sort of the native peas. And you get to talk a little bit about the rise of agriculture in the South, because those red peas took off, again, brought from Africa like so much, and originally were grown just by sort of the enslaved Africans on the family plots that they had mm-hmm. here. But in the early 1820s or so, there was discovered that those were great sort of crops to nourish the soil. So they ended up, farmers across the South started planting cowpeas or red peas or those types of field peas in between the rows of cotton and other and corn and other agricultural crops. Mm-hmm. And so they became huge at that time. I thought that I had to do – I thought oysters was an interesting one to do, because I talked about oyster bars, but also the rise of the oyster roasts and the oyster cannery industry right. here that was really big. And then I talked about she crab soup, which you can't really talk about Charleston cuisine without she crab soup, the signature city. But of course, told how it was created. But it's really that bridge between Charleston in the 1920s and 1930s, when there really wasn't much in the way of commercial dining. She crab soup started off as a home meal. Mm-hmm. It's actually William Dees, who was the butler for the Rhett family, the former mayor, prominent lawyer. He was their butler and cook, and he sort of came up with it as a signature dish there. 1930 got published in 200 Years of Charleston Cooking, so it became a very popular recipe in Charleston homes. And then he went on, William Dees went on to get a job cooking for Everett's Restaurant, which is no longer around, but was up on Cannon Street, which was at the time was the edge of Charleston. It was like that was the highway out of town. Yeah. And he made it famous there. So it was a transition to restaurants, and sort of that led into the rise of restaurants.
The new restaurant at the Vendue Revival mm-hmm. serves a great she crab soup.
Yeah, that's actually it's worth maybe a deviation of the she yeah. crab soup, because I've tried to find like really great she crab soup. It's yep. hard to find.
It's really hard to find. So my leading contender prior to Revival opening was the she crab at Roadside Seafood.
Mm-hmm. I always like that.
Yep. I think that was kind of top of the list for me, but I would encourage you to try the one at Revival.
I'll have to go.
Yep. See, and it has William Dees' name on it. Oh. So they're
pretty
serious about it.
I've got two recipes from William Dees. Mm-hmm. There was one was published in 1930,
yep.
and that was a home recipe that was published in the 200 Years of Charleston Cooking. And then someone sent me a promotional pamphlet from Everett's
oh.
Restaurant.
Oh, interesting. I'm not seeing one with the recipe on it.
That has a recipe in it.
Cool.
And so it's Dees' recipe from the restaurant. And they're almost, I can't remember, but they're very similar.
Okay.
And I've cooked according to both of them. Mm-hmm. I feel like the secret is you got to have crab roe and you got to get them fresh from whole crabs. Because yeah. I've tried it with frozen crab roe. It just doesn't work. But most people gum up their soup. They make one of these thick kind of right. fluffy, so you can stand yeah. a spoon up in
exactly.
it. It's just not a pleasant thing to eat.
No.
The best are like sort of almost a thin, not too thin, but mm-hmm. almost more like a bisque or something
right.
with lots of crab meat in it. And
yeah.
good flavor. So, yep. All right, Revival. I'll have to check that
absolutely.
One out. Absolutely. Can't remember. I had a bunch of other ones I tried to work in along the way. I definitely had –
Wait, that's it? You don't remember the rest of your
list?
No,
I remember. Oh, right. I can't remember the ones I discarded
the list. Gotcha.
And I may not get all 10 of them. Yep. I may forget one along the way here. But I put fried whiting
uh-huh. oh, that's a good one.
On there, which is not something you think of about Charleston yeah. unless you go into one of the sort of neighborhood seafood joints,
right?
Which most of them will serve fried whiting, hard for me to say.
Yeah.
But it dates – that's sort of like the old generation of fish that right. was caught – in Charleston by the mosquito fleet.
Right. These people guys. May have heard of Porgy and Bess.
Yep. Porgy yep. and Bess. Yep. Porgy was another. So
yep.
Porgy was a
fish,
and whiting was another fish. And, yep. and I think black sea bass was what the mosquito fleet mm-hmm. tended to catch. We went out in these little rickety boats. They go way off. They go off out of sight of land. They go mm-hmm. 20 miles off fishing and with no with just dead reckoning. Like yeah. so no instruments or anything. And then would just know to turn around and head back, and I guess they saw land eventually, so they just sort of did that. Also, learners reading up on that, a lot of the fishermen couldn't swim, which I thought was really interesting. Huh. If you're going out that far in the water, And
maybe you're superstitious.
So maybe it could be a suit. I don't know. But so, some of the prominent like fishermen end up dying because their boat capsized, and that was it. So it's just like this crazy to think that you go all that far off and without any instruments.
That's terrifying.
And yeah, I'd be absolutely just.
All right, what else is on the list?
Wait. Well, fried whiting stick. The mosquito fleet's long gone, but the fried whiting is still around. But,
oh, yeah.
You know, if you see it in Charleston,
it's good with grits. You know,
eat it. I think shrimp and grits, I've already skipped ahead. So I finished with shrimp and grits, and I finished with triggerfish.
That's all 10?
Yeah, I think that's 10.
All right.
Did I get them all? I'll have to go back in.
All right.
We bounced around a little
bit.
Did
you name any? Oh, yes, you did. Okay. I'm trying to think if anything's left out. It's a good list.
It was interesting. I had other things like. You can call it frogmore stew or low country boil, which I ended up jettisoning it because I was like, well, what does that really tell the history of? And we got seafood,
right?
Here we got crabs, we got shrimp, but I thought that was the oysters covered it a lot better, and whiting, fried whiting, it covers it a lot better. Mm-hmm. Triggerfish really represents the new form of Charleston cooking, which is this ultra fresh, formerly trash species, and now cost you $15 a pound.
Yeah.
So that's a metaphor for Charleston in the last 10 or 15
Perfect.
Years.
Yep. Good. All right.
Do we have any other 5 and 10s? I found it like lists. I like these kind of lists.
People love lists.
Yeah. And I gripe about.
Yeah. No,
I gripe about listicles.
Right.
I gripe about the going and saying the 10 best restaurants you have to eat at.
Look, if a list is knowledgeable, there's nothing wrong with a list. Yeah, I just had to do one of these two, and I wish I could remember how it was. I did this for Parts Unknown, same thing, it was the online version. They needed 5 things you needed to read, watch, or see before coming to Charleston.
Oh, that's good.
And that's a fun one.
See, I like that. I also like that those five signs of a Southern restaurant that readers gave you because it makes you sit down and think through it.
It really is. It's actually a good exercise. And I think we shouldn't be so quick to dismiss lists. I think we just want to dismiss bad lists.
Yes. So did you have 5 while we're at it?
Or what's that?
Can you give your 5 things to read?
I started with Blaine Roberts and Ethan Keitel's new book, Denmark Bessie's Garden, which is a fantastic book about how Charleston has remembered the Civil War ever since the Civil War and everything surrounding it. The book has this tremendous prologue, kind of setting the scene pre-Civil War. In terms of just how slavery dominated the landscape. One of the things I was talking about with another reporter recently, which is interesting, is some of the new restaurants that are opening all the way down there, like on Broad Street, are in places that were, I mean, obviously every place had something to do with the slave trade. But for instance, the establishment is in the old, was more of like an auction house, which I think is interesting. So this is exactly what that's about, is setting that scene.
That's a good one for visiting Charleston. That's what slavery and antebellum, the South and all that, and that whole thing got so romanticized in sort of like the popular imagination by Gone with the Wind.
Right. Well, this around, is a book about how the romanticization happened. So this is not a food book.
It's not even about really – it's more about what happened after the Civil War, right?
Primarily,
we got to where we are today.
It is. But so I just think anyone who's visiting Charleston, even if you're coming exclusively to eat, it's worth reading the first few pages.
Well, that's why I say I like that because Charleston's been – this is not Charleston's not Gone with the Wind and Tara and these, it's even a cotton plant. It's a very different place. And I think a lot of people come, just sort of regular tourists come with like just visions of this misty South that is like not only a myth and silly, but it's actually not even like we're not in the right town for that kind of thing.
That's
this is
right.
Different history and a totally different.
Right. And it was a commercial center. I mean, this was in many ways. So it's not, I mean, not that there weren't places out and about, but if you come to the city, it's not it was not a working.
No, this was a port.
This was a port,
all the rice came to get funneled out to the world.
Right. So I said that. I said to read some Pat Conroy, to read or to watch Daughters of the Dust, which is Julie Dash's film, just to kind of immerse yourself in the Gullah culture there. And lastly, and I'm saying lastly, but I'm counting 4, so I'm forgetting something.
Pat Conroy was South Abroad. You had a Josephine Pinkney's 3 o'clock dinner.
I wanted to finish up with that. All right.
Well, I'll go before that. I pulled it up. Madness Rules the Hour.
Madness Rules the Hour, which is I really liked. It's another great book about the Democrat convention that was held here prior to the Civil War, and just does a really good job of dramatizing how rabidly racist Charleston was. It's a really good read in terms of the city's politics then, and in some ways
now. And it definitely will tee you up, because all that was happening on the same streets where you'll be walking if you visit Charleston.
Exactly.
You know, a lot of buildings burned, a lot of the buildings are still here.
So that's a good one. And so again, wanted to finish with 3 o'clock dinner, mm-hmm. just because I wanted to bring it back around to food. So that one's a novel or a short story, but it is about Charleston's anxieties about change, which are also longstanding.
I'll have to go read them.
Oh, and so it's great. So it was a longstanding tradition in Charleston is that you had 3 o'clock dinner as opposed to a later meal. And so this book is set, I think, in like 30s or 40s, but the idea is they're no longer eating 3 o'clock dinner. They're just eating supper. And so it's a good book about Charleston and the way it's always eaten.
Right. See, that's why I like this. I like those lists to wrap up it, because ones that make you think, not ones that are quick hit.
Right.
Know, here's 10 pictures, scroll through them and go. But also, you get an argument started too, all these Southern restaurants.
Exactly. Right.
So good. Thanks to the reader for sending that in. That sparked a good discussion.
Absolutely. That is all for this edition of The Winnow. We recorded today's episode in the legitimately Southern podcasting
studios
at the Post and Courier.
We don't have a shrine on the wall, though. We need to get one.
We should bring one in downtown Charleston, South Carolina. If you enjoy listening to The Winnow, help other listeners find us, too. Just go to iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you access your podcast and like us or leave a rating. The Winnow is a production of the Post and Courier and Palmetto New Media. Our producer today was the...
Top five.
Say
my
Parker.
Top five.
I wanted to say straw hat wearing. I like that idea.
He is actually sitting here in a straw hat and overalls.
Straw hat. We require it. Our theme music is by the Bluestone Ramblers.
Until next time, I'm Robert Moss.
And I'm Hannah Raskin.
Now get out there and eat.